That was exciting. That's Little Feat featuring Emmylou Harris and the song Sailin' Shoes. Dave Van Ronk before that brought us You've Been a Good Old Wagon. It was Bob Dylan with To Be Alone With You from the Nashville Skyline album, and the New Basement tapes featuring Elvis Costello with Lost on the River. You're listening to Undercurrents. I'm Gavriela. Johnny Lang is around the corner in just a minute.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, on 90.7 FM, K282 BH, Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon. Go Ducks!
One thing I hear from so many of my ADHD students all the time is like, if I hear one more person tell me to buy a planner, I'm just going to lose my mind because it just doesn't work.
I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle. Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, before we get to today's show, here's a reminder that our membership drive is going on now through September 20th. And as you know, KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by listeners like you. This year, we relied on $110,000 in grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Since they're going to be closing now, those funds will not be available for 2025. This is difficult and frustrating, but together we can keep the station alive and thriving for many more years to come. It's been 56 years and counting, but we need your support to continue delivering quality independent programming. Help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal. Please just go to kboo.fm/give to show your support. Well, today we have a memoir about love. That's our show, Love in Action, the story of love in action. Now, whether it is that we're trying to silence shame or show up for friends or rebound after failure or overcome the dreaded what ifs, we all could use a renewed sense of love. It can be a guiding source in our lives that brings greater peace, purpose, and connection, all of which are necessary for creating positive change during these difficult times. Our guest today is Scott Stabile, author of Big Love, The Undeniable Joy of Following Your Heart. Scott is a passionate love advocate who believes there is no force more powerful than love to create real connection and healing in our worlds. He guides transformational breathwork journeys and leads personal empowerment workshops internationally. His inspirational posts have attracted a huge and devoted social media following, including now more than 350,000 Facebook fans. He is also the author of two more books, Just Love and Enough As You Are. Hello, Scott, and welcome to Pathways.
Hey there, Paul. Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
Okay, so you just keep writing about love. What the hell's going on here? What's the overall purpose? And what's your goal in writing a memoir like this?
You know, I believe deeply that love is our most powerful force for healing and connection. And for whatever reason, I continuously feel the call to make noise for that power. So that's really ultimately most of the work I do is rooted in love and self-love and reminding ourselves of what we can create when we align with those energies.
So is this a reflection of a challenge, a particular challenge that you've had in your life, the challenge of self-love?
I mean, sure, but I don't necessarily think more so than most people. You know, I think that we all struggle to really love ourselves, to really be compassionate and kind and forgiving with ourselves. I really have yet to meet anybody who hasn't at some point or still currently doesn't have to contend with that, because we have really self-abusive minds, all of us. And we have to contend with our minds continuously. So for me, the only way I've learned to actually be with my mind in a way that creates peace for me is to continuously put energy toward self-love in different ways.
Okay. Now, this word love is a very big word. It has lots of different meanings and definitions. It's like the word snow for the Eskimos. You know? So how would you, for the purposes of your discussion, how would you define love? What does it mean?
Yeah, that's an important question. First, I just want to say I'm speaking to you just from my experience and my understanding of things. I see love as energy. So for me, it's an energy that's alive inside of us, alive outside of us. And when we choose to engage with that energy, in the same way I see creativity as an energy, when you choose to engage with the energy of love, and I also see love as an umbrella term for compassion, forgiveness, kindness, empathy, all the things that love informs in our lives. And what I've witnessed in my own life is that anytime I engage with the energy of love, I just feel better, man. Like, that's ultimately what it comes down to. I feel more at home in my being. I feel more peaceful. I feel like what I have to offer the world is better. It actually contributes and fosters deeper connections, more open and loving connections. So that's how I see love. And what for me feels so powerful about that is just understanding that at any point we can decide to engage with the energy of love. We can ask ourselves, what is love inviting me to do right now? How is love asking me to show up? And then play and see.
What would you say is the biggest obstacle for that to happen?
Fear, our minds, conditioning, insecurity. You know what I mean? All of the, we grow up conditioned to within an inch of our lives about everything, what we're supposed to think, who we're supposed to love, how we're supposed to be in the world, and really kind of transcending that conditioning and getting in touch with what feels most authentically true to you, not what feels most expected by others for you, is a really, it can be a very challenging journey, because it requires us to be courageous enough to say, hey, this is who I am, despite who you want me to be or despite what society wants me to be. And I feel like the more we love ourselves, the more capable we are of making that choice, because we know as people judge us, as they always do, or when we face rejection or failure or whatever else, that we've got our own backs. And that for me, the difference between how I am now versus 10 years ago, if I were to fail at something, I would have been my worst critic on the other side of that failure. And when you're your own worst critic, in my experience, you're less inclined to take risks. You're less inclined to make changes, because you know that if it doesn't go well, you're going to beat yourself up in a bad way. But when you know you've got your back, when you know that you love yourself no matter what, and you can be compassionate with yourself and offer yourself grace no matter what, you're like, okay, I'll try things. I'll take chances, because I'm going to support myself on the other side of it. So it makes us more courageous.
You know, what do you think, how important is how loved we were by our primary caretakers relative to our ongoing ability to love ourselves?
I think it's very important, in that if you were raised by people who were in any way emotionally abusive, or, you know, we're telling you that you're worthless or stupid or whatever, these are communications that we really internalize and carry with us into our lives. And I've met people with very loving parents who would say their parents are very loving, and they still struggle to love themselves. So it just being raised by loving parents doesn't mean you're going to move through life and love yourself necessarily. I do think it helps. The more people we have in our lives who are supporting us and championing us, the more likely I think we can be to recognize, okay, if I have this person, that person, who are all telling me I'm a worthy, loving human being, maybe I'll catch on a bit more quickly. But it's not a given, because you still have a world, you still have media and government and PR firms who are giving a lot of energy to telling you in some way that you are flawed. And you need to do this in order to not be flawed. So we're still internalizing those messages.
Now, you had some particular severe challenges in your life. I'm referring to the fact that your parents were murdered when you were 14. And I'm wondering, how did losing them in such a violent way at such a young age impact your dedication to give and receive and to live life from love?
The truth is, Paul, I can't say for certain how my childhood and the trauma of losing my parents landed me where I am today, which is to say, had I not lost them, it's entirely possible that I would still be out here making a lot of noise for the energy of love. What I can say is that losing my parents in that way and dealing with that trauma, I do feel like it helped me become a more compassionate and empathetic person. It helped me be someone who is more willing to connect with the humanity of other people, no matter how they're showing up in the world. And I think that those of us, which is basically anyone who's an adult at this point, those of us who've been through trauma and have experienced hardship in our lives, hopefully that's opened our hearts to see and connect with others in a deeper way. But I do remember myself as a really compassionate kid and a really sweet, loving kid. So it's possible I would have arrived here just by a different path.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering, if you don't mind, what is the story? And your folks had a store and somebody came to rob the store and in the process shot them? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I mean, according to the police report, I mean, the person who killed them was a customer, so they knew him and they let him into the store. Actually, it was their employee who was there prior to them who let this man into the store, and this man stabbed my parents' employee, who was a really lovely man named T. And then my parents walked in on that scene, and when my father went to call 911, this man shot both my parents and killed them as well.
Amazing. Now, you have a lot of sharing in your memoir about how you ultimately came to forgive the man who murdered your parents. And this is a very dramatic thing. And I'm wondering, did you ever make contact with him or get to know him at all?
I didn't make contact with him or get to know him. So for me, the forgiveness of him was my own journey and my own story. But I would like to share a little bit about that if you're open to it.
Go ahead.
It's really one of the greatest gifts I've experienced in my life. And it came from the worst thing I've experienced in my life, which was seeing my capacity to forgive something that most people look upon as unforgivable. And the way that happened for me was just in my early 20s, really being aware of how through my, you know, from 14 to my early 20s, whenever I would think about the man who killed my parents, I would just be filled with hate and, you know, wish him dead and think horrible scenarios about him dying. And in my early 20s, when I really started to awaken to a path of love in this life, I really started to see how thinking about this man in this way was taking not just an emotional, but a physical toll. Like, I felt the anxiety in my body. And so I didn't know how I would come to forgiveness, but I knew I had to approach him differently when I would think about him. And so what I chose to do was just to do my best to empathize with what I imagined his experience to be. And what that looked like for me was I imagined anyone who could kill three people must feel very angry, very lost, very hurt, very confused. And I didn't know like all the details of his story, obviously, but I felt like, you know what? I feel very lost. I feel very angry. I feel very hurt. I feel very confused. And even the violence, which I thought was something I could never relate to, that level of violence, when I got honest with myself, I was like, you've been imagining him dying gruesome deaths for years. Like, you can relate. Like, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily follow through on the violence, but it's not accurate to say you can't imagine that kind of violence. And so even that, I thought, we are no different, this man and I. And I am not going to look upon him as just a murderer. And so choosing to empathize with him allowed me to open my heart to him and allowed love to show up for him. And then what I came to discover when I thought about him is I've forgiven this man, you know, and that was a profoundly powerful thing for me to realize.
It occurs to me that it would have made empathy easier if you had, you know, gotten to know him a little bit or had contact with him. Were you at all tempted to do that?
I've been tempted through the years, and just never followed through with doing it. But to what you just said, Paul, what I want to say is that's really one of the things I appreciate so much about empathy is, like, forgiveness isn't, for me, is not a choice. I don't think you can just call forgiveness out of the sky and suddenly forgive someone whom you feel has really hurt or betrayed you. Empathy, however, is something you can just decide in the moment. I'm going to take a moment now and imagine what the lived experience of this person might be like. Imagine why they would have done what they've chosen to do. And in just that choice with anyone, I'm having to do it constantly right now with politicians and have for years, you know, like just choosing to remember that had I walked in this person's shoes, I may have arrived at the exact place they have arrived at right now. And because I can't say for sure that I wouldn't, I am going to nudge myself back into a compassionate and loving place with this person too. And by the way, I'm struggling a lot right now to stay in my heart with people. And you know, that's the work.
I understand. I mean, it's not easy right now to understand a lot of things that people do. And I know for me, it's like, seems important to try to, in order to put myself in somebody else's shoes, that's a function of understanding them. And, you know, you can make the assumption, well, everybody's doing the best they can, given their conditioning and given their wounds, etc. But I think it helps if you understand what it was that they were dealing with. But I really, it's very impressive how you can will yourself to forgive somebody without the understanding or by.
Well, I can will myself to be empathetic, and in my experience, empathy is the path to forgiveness. Like, there needs to be empathy there. I don't know that I can't honestly say I can will myself to forgiveness, but I definitely can will myself to be empathetic with people.
Okay. Well, some people would consider that to be a perfectionistic belief about your ability to love, that you can empathize with people that you don't understand. But awesome.
That's again, you know what it is? Really what it comes down to is just understanding that for you, Paul, I don't know your life. I haven't walked your path. But what I know is if I had walked your path, I might have landed where you've landed. And that allows me to open my heart to you if you're saying horrible things to me. It's like, okay, I might have landed there and gotten to his understanding too had I lived the however many years you've lived on this planet. And that allows me to open my heart more empathetically. Okay. But also, it doesn't condone behavior. I'm not condoning terrible behavior. It creates more peace in me. Like, I don't want to move through the world hating people. It doesn't feel good. So I'm selfishly always looking like, how can I create a bit more peace in my life? And love is continuously a pathway to that.
Okay, so where are you at now with saviors or gurus or leaders of cults? You know, because in your book, you tell quite a bit about your experience, 13 years in a cult. It certainly matches the definition that I know. But what compelled you to join a cult, and And why did you finally decide to walk away from it?
What compelled me to join, I met lots of people in San Francisco at the job I was working in a retail shop who were just beautiful people that I was becoming really close friends with. And unbeknownst to me initially, they were all disciples of this guru. They were all a part of this cult. And so it was only a matter of time before I was like, I want to meet this guru that you're crediting with all your joy and all your happiness. And I moved out to San Francisco from Michigan. I'd never heard the term enlightenment, I don't think, prior to moving there. I did not know about gurus or any of this world. And when I met him, he was super charming and very loving. And I hadn't had a really positive male role model in my life. And I think that was part of it. And an older man being really, like, really loving me in a beautiful way. And, not sexually, just to be clear. You know, and it was addictive. I just was surrounded by people who were committing their lives to being more loving and more peaceful. And I'm like, this is something we can do. We can focus on this instead of like the next career choice or whatever else. So that's what got me in. And what kept me in was just all the love. And what had me walk away was realizing that, you know, my guru professed himself to be an enlightened master. And I worked hard to believe that and did believe it until I couldn't believe it anymore. Like the things he was saying and doing just didn't align with what I imagined enlightenment looked like. And it became clear that this was no longer the path for me.
Right.
So I walked away.
Well, congrats.
And lost all my, I mean, he told them to delete me from their life and they all did. So I lost like 20 of the closest people in my life overnight, which I knew could happen, which is why it took me a year from the time I was clear I wanted to leave until I left, because I knew I might be sacrificing this community who was like my family.
Now, you have a lot to say in your book about happiness, and it kind of ties in here. You know, it's sort of like, in fact, one of your chapter titles is The Happiness Challenge. So how would you position happiness in your approach to it? Obviously, we can't be happy all the time. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think there are any number of memes that proclaim in some way happiness is a choice. And I'm sure that's even something I've shared in my Facebook page over the years. And I really came to realize happiness is not a choice. If it were a choice, we'd all be choosing it. We'd all be happy. So obviously there's more to experiencing happiness than just deciding I'm happy now. But what I did come to understand is that happiness may not be a choice, but the actions we take in our lives that lead to happiness are absolutely a choice. So I might not be able to just call happiness out of the sky, but I happen to love tennis and play tennis. And I know that when I play tennis, there's a really decent chance I'm going to generate some happiness in my life. So choosing to play tennis is very different than trying to choose happiness, but the outcome ends up being that choosing to play tennis means for me, generally, I'm choosing some version of happiness. So the invitation for people, from my perspective, is to get clear and look at the things you can do in your life that tend to lead you to more moments of joy, and do those things more often, and you're likely to feel joyful more often. It's like 1 + 1 = 2. And I think we forget sometimes how simple some of these spiritual practices are. It's like, do more of what feels good, you feel good more often. Do less of what feels bad, and you feel bad less often, ideally.
Now, you write quite a bit about fear. How, and fear, obviously, is not the friend of happiness. How do you characterize the voice of fear within you?
You know, I used to characterize it as a big tyrannical bully, but I've come to really see that my fear is just a protector. Everyone's fear is a protector. That's how I see it. So I engage with my fear as much as possible as just a friend in my life who's trying to keep me safe and protected from uncomfortable experiences. However, the way it goes about it is as a complete, like, irrational helicopter parent. So it's not bringing a lot of emotional intelligence. It's approaching everything with the ferocity of like me running into oncoming traffic, when in fact, maybe I'm just trying to ask someone out on a date. You know, it's like, you don't have to be as scared as you would be running into a burning building. But for fear, it's like, don't do it. You could get rejected. You could be uncomfortable. So I recognize my fear is just trying to keep me safe. And instead of approaching it like the tyrannical bully, now I see it like a younger brother who's tugging on my pant leg, like, no, 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 no. But how I engage with it is what's important, because when you view any part of what's happening within as an enemy and you go to war with it, you just create more war within yourself. So I'm choosing to view all the parts of who I am as through the lens of friendship. I want to go to friendship with every aspect of who I am, and then bring my own emotional intelligence to each of those characteristics as they come up.
Sounds like a good formula.
Yeah, and it's not always easy. It's so easy. We're having this conversation. I'm saying these things, and it's like, these things are simple concepts, but actually living into them, it takes intention, it takes work, and I fail often. And one of the things self-love implores me to do is, when I'm not showing up the way I would ideally like to be for my life, is just to give myself a bunch of grace. It's like, that's the nature of being human. We're not always going to make healthy choices. And that's okay.
How does writing help you?
Writing helps because it's like, it's one, when I write, I tend to open up pathways that I'm not getting to when I'm just thinking through stuff. When I'm just thinking through stuff, I'm usually like a hamster on a wheel going through the same points again and again and again. But when I start to write it out, I see that I come up with different perspectives usually that can be more helpful. And also, writing is a great way to just vomit out what, you know, it feels like energetically like vomiting. If I'm enraged by something and I'm just living with the rage, versus putting it out on the paper, I feel like I'm actually moving some of that energy in a way that serves me.
Right, right. And that comes across. I mean, I love how personal you are in your book. What do you hope readers will take away from Big Love?
I hope they'll see that they're not alone, honestly, in whatever struggles they're experiencing. If the internet has been good for one thing, it's to show us, my goodness, there are so many others who are feeling, living the types of circumstances that we're living. And I think there's a comfort in knowing you're not the only one. I hope people are reminded that they are truly worthy as they are. Your worth is inherent. It's not something you have to achieve. You were born worthy. You will die worthy. You know, I hope people remember that others are worthy as they are too. And that the more we prioritize our relationship to self, the more likely we are to offer to others what we're learning in that prioritization, which is like more compassion, more kindness, more empathy. And maybe we can be the example of what we want to see in the world if we choose to be.
And experience more big love. And that's, of course, a perfect way to end today, because there's so much more we could explore, but we've run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, scottstabile.com. It's all one word, Scott, scottstabile.com, where you can go for more information about Scott's work and his books. And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Scott Stabile, author of Big Love, The Undeniable Joy of Following Your Heart. And I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast on KBOO.FM in Portland, Oregon. Or perhaps you subscribe to our podcast version for free, which you can find at divination.com, that's spelled divination.com, as well as by searching Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. Please feel free to forward a link to all your friends. We here at KBOO Community Radio want to assure our listeners that despite losing federal funding radio grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we will continue to unapologetically represent the voices of our community. With the loss of $110,000 of federal funding, We're counting on supporters like you to help make up the loss so KBOO can continue our important mission in these difficult and unpredictable times. It takes a village to build community, and we welcome you to become a member today. Please do. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 4431. Thank you. And this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Podcasts. And thanks again to Scott Stabile and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways Conversation.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive.